the book of Esther, the way we order the Old Testament comes up towards the beginning of the Old Testament. It's right after Ezra and Nehemiah. It's before Job, immediately before Job and before Psalms and Isaiah and Jeremiah. It fits chronologically with Ezra and Nehemiah. It is, and it fits with last week's reading from Habakkuk. Esther is much easier to pronounce than Habakkuk. But this is one of those passages about when the people of God are in captivity and they are not at home and they are not in charge of their own lives and their own world, which actually seems to be where they spend most of their time. We date this encounter to roughly the 6th century BC. Esther is in charge of things essentially because she won a beauty pageant after the previous queen refused to answer the king's summons. This is halfway through the story, almost exactly in the middle of the book of Esther. And what has happened so far is that Vashti has gone to the sidelines. Esther has won the prize. She has worked her way through the halls of power in the harem and is at the top of the king's priority list and has ingratiated herself with most of the household staff of the king as well. And her uncle Mordecai is kind of a large public figure, and he has made a large public enemy in Haman, the king's advisor. And Mordecai will not bow down to Haman's idol that he wears pinned to his clothes. And so Haman has done, Haman has gone the opposite direction, and Haman has decided that all the Jews must die because of this. And this is what happens then. When Mordecai learned all that had been done, Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went through the city, wailing with a loud and bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. In every province, wherever the king's command and his decree came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and most of them in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's maids and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called for Hatshak, one of the king's eunuchs who had been appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai and learn what was happening and why. Hatshak went to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened and the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther, explain it to her, and charge her to go to the king to make supplication to him and entreat him for her people. Hatshak went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. Then Esther spoke to him and gave him a message for Mordecai, saying, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law. All alike are to be put to death. Only if the king holds out the golden scepter to someone may that person live. I myself have not been called to come into the king for 30 days. This is where I was supposed to stop. So now the second lesson. When they told Mordecai what Esther had said, Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not think that in the king's palace you will escape more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silence at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter, but you and your father's family will perish. Who knows? Perhaps you have come to royal dignity for just such a time as this. Then Esther said in reply to Mordecai, "Go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa, and hold a fast on my behalf, and neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will also fast as you do. After that, I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. Friends, this is the word of the Lord. Typically, when we study Esther, we take one of two branches on it. Oh, isn't it neat? It's one of two books of the Bible named after a woman, and that's really unusual. Okay, did you or did you not just hear us do two stories about how God saves the people through a woman? And that was just before we got to the first hymn. The other thing is that we tend to say that God isn't in this book. And literally, the word God is not in the book. But you can't read the book and not hear God. The bigger challenge, I think, in this one is understanding that this is not the first time we hear this story, and it's not the last, and we're a little slow, just a little, but that this story echoes through the years. The first Christian creed of the early church is Jesus is Lord. It goes up and against a creed of Rome that says Caesar is Lord. Now, as stiff-necked as the people of the Old Testament and, to be honest, the New Testament are, we don't like getting told what to do. So when Haman says, "Everybody must bow down to me and my idols," Mordecai says, "No, that's not who we are." Now keep in mind, they're doing that in exile. They're not in charge. They're very much not in charge. Like they weren't in charge in Egypt. Like they weren't in charge in Persia. Like they won't be in charge in 1933 in Germany. Okay, this is not a story that's just trapped 600 years ago. Because there's another story that I don't know if you know that well. I made a picture of it. I searched the internet. I did not draw this. I am not claiming credit for the artistic rendering. I just found it. There's a crossbow and a little boy and an apple. Does that tell you what the story is? William Tell, right? What I don't know if you know is about this hat in the background on top of the pole. The rule was you had to bow down to the hat or else. And the part of the story that we know really well, the apple and the bow and the little boy, is the or else. Does that sound like a story we just read? There are lots of ways in which the scriptural story echoes through the rest of history. And we need to listen to it. Do you know the root word of the word ghetto? Do you know where it comes from? We think of it now as like inner cities, right? And in America, we think of it as where black people live. It comes from the part of town where Jews were allowed to live. It's a 12th, 13th century word. It comes out of Italy. It went from being Jews to where lepers were allowed to live. Those sorts of things. So this piece of this story of the Jews being not in charge and things being put on them is not just an Esther, isn't that nice, it's an Old Testament story sort of thing. And to get back to the first point, can we give up on thinking that God doesn't use women? I mean, like, it's the second Sunday in Advent and the angel Gabriel just came to Mary. And her cousin Elizabeth is pregnant and with child. and we're reading this story of it. Can we give up on this idea that God using women is somehow weird? 70% of you sitting in the sanctuary are women. Can I get some nods, please? Ironically, that's demographically true in America, regardless of denomination or theology or anything else. 70% of the people in the pews on any given Sunday are women. So if you think your church functions without women, you are probably delusional. So approaching this story as though it is part of the main story of the people of God and not some outlier. Mordecai is a bit of a drama queen, okay? Like, he is normally a politician. He's like an attorney, lobbyist, businessman. He meets with the king and his advisors on a regular basis. And now he has taken off his $1,000 Gucci suit and has put on sackcloth and ashes and roamed through the streets and wailed at the top of his lungs like he just had a psychotic break. I mean, he's got Esther's attention. He probably has most of town's attention. They probably think he's off his rocker. There's also not a thing he can do about the situation. He doesn't have access to anybody who can do anything. So he tries to get access to Esther. And he gets access. Because, frankly, it reads like Esther's kind of embarrassed that her favorite uncle is sitting out there in sackcloth and ashes. Hey, Mordecai, would you please put some clothes on? The way that would read in this congregation is, would you please put some shoes on? See? It's not a dead book. It's still very relevant. And he says, no, here's all the evidence. This is what's happening. This is what is going to happen to your people. And don't be so delusional that living in the palace is going to save you, because it'll come for you. Then we get the next piece, the piece that is kind of the memory verse for the book of Esther. It's on the front of your bulletins today. Perhaps you were put in royal dignity for such a time as this. I mean, as a rule for faith, perhaps you are where you are for the situation that's happening around you is about as basic as it comes. Right? Maybe you're there driving down the road when they have a flat tire precisely because they're there and they need somebody at that moment. Maybe that's why you're there. Maybe that's why you're there. How many of you have ever received a phone call from exactly the right person at exactly the right moment? How many of you have ever been told you called exactly the right person at exactly the right moment? Right? Now, do we believe that's coincidence or do we think that's God? That's part of what Mordecai is saying, is that there are no coincidences. You are where you are because this is where you need to be. We tend to stop after that happy-go-lucky memory verse, okay? But Mordecai goes on a little bit. And if you don't do it, sister, God will make sure it happens anyway. Now, that is a profound piece of faith for a guy sitting in sackcloth and ashes with a death sentence over his entire people. Is it not? I have my niece that I raised as the queen of the country, and I am gutsy enough to tell her that if she doesn't get off her duff and do something, it's okay, God's still going to handle it. Most of us, when we're calling in favors like, I need a favor from the queen, that's the end of my list. If I got the queen on the phone, I really have nowhere else to go from there, right? Mordecai has a deep confidence that God is going to see God's people through this. And that confidence comes all the way forward to what the people are waiting for in the Messiah, in the child who's going to get born of Mary. There's one more echo in this passage. I don't know if you caught it. Granger has trained you really well to listen for these things. I don't know if you caught it or not. How long are the people going to fast and pray before she goes to die? Have you heard anything else in the Bible about life and death being separated by 3 days? So it happens once or twice. It happens with this Jesus character. It happens with Abraham and Isaac. Their journey to the mountain for Isaac to be sacrificed is 3 days. It happens with Jonah and the whale. It happens with Lazarus. It's the narrative of Easter. And one of our challenges is to believe that stuff is real. That God can spin life from death. And that one person really does make a difference. Okay? One person. One of the things we have a tendency to forget, because Jesus is this really large, bigger-than-life character, there's just one of him. I mean, do you see all the trouble he causes? He only does one person's job for 3 years, and they want to kill him. One person can make a difference. And so I went looking for things, and I had a, oh, dear God, how am I that old moment? There was an event that happened in 1989 that I did not remember was in 1989. I could have sworn it was later than that. And there is an iconic picture of that event. Tiananmen Square, May 1989. And the iconic picture is this one tiny little man and these four not so tiny tanks. And by the way, in case you're wondering, he does not have pedestrians right of way. The tank has the right of way. Now, that story doesn't end theologically, politically, with the upswing of Easter. But it is a powerful reminder to us that the story of Esther, that the story of one person who speaks for the many, who speaks for life in the midst of death, is not over. We are moving both ever so slowly and incredibly quickly towards Christmas, depending on which checklist I'm looking at any given moment. And it is easy for us to forget how much of this narrative hinges on one person at a time being faithful. God doesn't need to convince everybody in Jerusalem that God is doing a new thing. He thumps Zechariah upside the head. Elizabeth goes along for the ride. Gabriel comes to Mary, says yes to something she has no idea the depth of what she's getting into, and yet she does. I'm not sure you can meet Gabriel and not have an idea that you're in over your head. And the rest of the story happens when we get to Christmas Eve. We'll talk about shepherds. We get to Epiphany. We'll talk about wise men. In between, we may talk about Anna and Simeon. The story of the salvation of the world never depends on the crowd getting it. It always depends on one person at a time being faithful. So as you go out, may the memory verse echo in your ears for such a time as this. And may you take Mordecai's next line more as a threat and less as comfort, because God will find somebody to do it even if you don't. That's not letting us off the hook. To God alone be the glory this day and forevermore. Amen.